Chili Coco presents Side Project Spotlight, episode 64. This is a developer's journey into making cool stuff. I'm Kotaro.
I'm Steve.
And I'm Aaron.
And we are Philly Coco, a Philadelphia-based Coco Heads community focused on Apple development. That primarily, but not exclusively, means iOS, Mac, tvOS, watchOS, and visionOS development. Philly Coco's true desire is to take you higher on your own developer journey.
Right. Yes.
Yeah, there we go. Nice, clean intro for once.
We did it.
We did it.
It took 64 tries. It's,
well, you know.
It's been done.
Finally. So basically, the next one I'm going to like super flub up. What are we talking about today?
I don't know. I want to talk a little bit about some Swift data action I've been getting into lately. And okay. I know we want to talk a bit about Vision Pro accessibility, which I think would be fascinating because I haven't seen anybody else talking about that, but you have some direct experience, Kotaro. And then there's some time there at the end, maybe a little bit about that humane AI pin that everybody's talking about.
Or just interesting AI wearables or wearables in general.
Yeah, we're having some good Slack discussion about that.
I have sort of a question in that sense. Or I guess one of the things I'm going to be interested in with sort of Swift data, for people who don't know Swift data, see, what is Swift data?
Swift data is basically a wrapper around core data, but it is.
And what is core data?
it's the data persistence framework from Apple. It allows you to take an object graph and persist it, generally to a SQL database, but not technically exclusively to that. And it also lets you query the data, and it has a very memory efficient ways of fetching the data. And there's a whole way for you to write queries now that got updated as well as part of the Swift data launch. So you can, there's like a macro that lets you make predicates better. So there's a whole bunch of ways for you to persist your data and then query it in a memory efficient way and access it from, you know, places in your app. Integrates really well with Swift UI. Swift data and Swift UI are like a peanut butter and jelly sandwich.
Okay. Now, I have used core data in conjunction with Swift UI. They have some pretty nice convenient properties for fetch querying, for fundamentally pulling data out of, say, a SQL database, in most cases, a SQLite database. I'd say almost like 99% of the time.
I know it's like technically you can do other things with core data.
XML,
I haven't really
JSON,
heard of anyone doing it. PLIS, yeah, if you write an adapter. But Swift data, I don't know. I guess you can dig in there and get to that stuff, but Swift data just by default just gonna go to your SQLite database.
To be fair, one of the things that was frustrating for a lot of people about core data was it's sort of overly complex and annoying setup and
the way models worked or entities the management because the in Swift data it's everything's in code, so like that's where Apple's been moving with Swift UI too, like everything's defined in code, so you define your models in code and you can also define them as regular Swift classes more or less with a few rules depending on what you're doing. But you don't have to have everything be optional anymore. That's a big change. So you can have just actual properties that aren't optional and that'll work. And you don't have, and you can initialize, like you can create these objects by themselves.
Hold on. I'm sorry. Did you just say that I don't need to deal with the fact that almost every property in my entity that is optional? I can actually force it to be just a constant something that has to have a value in it.
A non-optional type. Yeah. I mean, you can do non-optional types as long as, you know, I think if you use CloudKit, you have to make sure that everything has a default value or is optional. But if you're not using CloudKit, I mean, you just make the model. Basically, you can just make things kind of like you intuitively would. And then you can tweak them as necessary. So,
but Steve.
Yeah.
What is CloudKit and why would I want to use it?
Well, I haven't used CloudKit much except for the times we experimented with it. But CloudKit would be like Apple's NoSQL database, I guess you would explain it. It's their way for you to synchronize your data into the cloud and, you know, move it between all of your devices. And it's, it has its quirks, but you've used it a lot more than either of us have.
Why, sure. I guess I have.
Yeah.
I guess one of the things that's so for
it's very easy to set up in Swift Data.
Yes. Oh, even in Core Data, it was relatively straightforward. Yeah. So for people who don't know, CloudKit is a way so that you can store your database that you built in Core Data and construct in Core Data. And you can have you can sync it to a cloud-based solution provided by Apple. And Apple's services are costs are relatively cheap, free for the most part.
If you're using if you're just storing stuff in your own private database, isn't that free for the developer?
Yes, it is free because the cost is actually on the user storage.
Yeah.
When the thing that makes it interesting, the way it makes it different is in a lot of ways is that because you are syncing CloudKit with your Core Data database. The Core Data database is mostly the one that's pushing the data over to CloudKit.
Right.
And then what's cool about that is like if you have an iPad version and an iPhone version, you update the iPhone version, it syncs up to CloudKit and it'll update your iPad version, assuming you're logged in through your iCloud account.
With the same one, same ID, yeah.
Right, and so it's all synced in that sense,
And it's
so
private, you're saying, which is nice.
Yes, yes. You can do a public version. Like, so, let's say, for example, both data sets share the same list of templated recipes. Say you have a recipe app, right, and you want to start the user with a default set of recipes, right? Might be the easiest to create a public database with a list of recipes that everyone could get access to, and that is relatively free based on storage, I believe. And that's on the developer cost, but the amount is so negligible. If you architect your database well, and they don't put too much data, getting to the limit, which is pretty generous, shouldn't happen at all, ever.
I mean, I'm going to look at it, stuff I'm doing just for thinking, but there's other options. Obviously, a lot of people use Firebase. It's very popular. And it's also cross-platform, whereas this is not. So that's the other thing.
How dare you, Steve?
I guess there is a JavaScript API for it, isn't there?
There is.
So I guess technically you could make it sort of cross-platform. I don't know anybody who's really successfully done that.
You can make it cross-platform with your iPad,
yeah,
your iPhone,
and your Mac,
your Apple TV, your Mac, and your now your Vision Pro.
Yeah, I know. If you want to go anything outside of Apple's ecosystem, probably use something else.
Actually, but I forgot. Doesn't watchOS support Cloud Core Data? I think Aaron, you would know this.
Yeah, we did it in our Watch app.
Oh, right, our Watch app.
Yeah,
Hanji Love. I'm sounding very salesy
today. So Swift Data is pretty cool. Mm-hmm. The thing I was trying to do with Swift Data, though, is I'm trying to get a bunch of data from an API and put it in Swift Data, and then have the user update a few things in there. Versus most of the tutorials and stuff you see about Core Data and Swift Data are about apps where it's mostly user created data. And there is like one page on the developer portal that I think has an example of loading stuff from an API into Swift Data. It's fairly straightforward. And I have some information in the show notes here. I found a nice article about like modern approaches to using Swift Data and Swift UI together. And also like a Donnie Walls video from like a year ago about the concurrency stuff. So the thing about Swift Data is, and Core Data in the past is you want to do things on the background when it's appropriate, things on the main context when it's UI based. And in Core Data, you could do child context, which we talked about, I think, a long time ago about using that for certain scenarios. So Swift Data apparently doesn't let you do child context. You can make background context, but the way that Swift Data works is they really heavily leverage Sendable and Swift concurrency. So, and the actor model. So with Swift Data, the approach that I found that I think is going to work, I've only done a little bit of data so far, is like I have an API. It kind of has a whole bunch of data I want to download from different endpoints. And so I have structs. So I have the way I actually structure my code, to keep things together, is I have a schema, and schema in Swift data is just, you just name it whatever you want. It's just basically like a little wrapper around your, you basically just name things, whatever your schema is. It's simple. Anyway, so I have a schema for like version one, and then I have like an object in there, and then in the same file, I have a DTO version of it. So what I did was I took the JSON, I made a codable struct, then I made a custom initializer for the Swift data model. So the model basically has the same properties, or almost the same properties. I made a custom initializer that takes in the DTO object and does the mapping, you know, back and forth to make it easy. Then I created a model. I used the macro model actor. So you create an actor in Swift. And so instead of saying like class or struct, you say actor. Use this, use model actor is one of those, you know, attributes you put on top, and it just rewrites your code. You can look at it if you want, and it sets you up so that you can more easily access the Swift data like container and context in there in a controlled manner. So you use the actor. There's some weirdness with actors, but use the actor to actually put the data into the database. Okay, so there's like two ways of doing it. You create the actor and you either give it all the dependencies it needs to like go to the internet and download stuff, or you do that stuff elsewhere and you give it the data that you want to put in. Like right now I have it set up so I'm taking in the data. So I have an actor, it has a method on it, or has a function on it. The function takes in a DTO object. Inside that function is where I access the Swift data context, and you know, I create the Swift data model from the DTO object. And then insert it into the database in there. And then when you want to access it again later, you use like a query property wrapper on a Swift UI view, and you access the data that way. And this seems to work pretty well so far. You just have to be aware that like the actors are finicky. Like you have to, they take on the like the context that they're created in. So if you make a model actor, like in a task or something, like it's going to be the main context. Like you have to create it in a detached task if you want it to be in a background.
Got you.
And there apparently was a bug in Xcode or something about this, where if you did a background actor, you did some inserts, it wasn't like necessarily updating properly to like queries, but I haven't seen that yet. So whatever. It seems to be working okay. So you should be able to make basically background updates that way, as long as you're careful about how you create it. And you really just want to take these model actors and create them wherever you want to use them. So and so you don't have like a state property somewhere that has like the one true actor object. You just create them wherever you want to create them, and then use them, because they're pretty lightweight to create, and that way they're kind of isolated. And it seems to be working pretty well. So I can grab some data. I haven't done a lot of data. I've just done a little bit so far, but it's kind of nice. I mean, it's really easy. It was really easy to set up. The other trick I would say is when you create your Swift data container, is to give it a name, give it a unique name. So and the app I'm playing with, this is my second Swift data container. And if you don't give at least one of them a specific name, they clobber each other on initialization, even if they're in like different view hierarchies, I found. Okay. Like they just like, but suddenly you get all these errors and be like, this table doesn't exist. And you're like, what's happening? You just have to give it a name when you create the container, that's all.
Got you. Okay, that's good to know.
Yeah.
Has any references or books or online tutorials helped at all in sort of grokking Swift data? Where have you gone to sort of like get like, is there was sample code, like there was there a sample code that was like, oh, that
yes dramatically. So Apple's basic developer documentation really useful, especially in my case. There's one document I have to find for the show notes that is just shows an example, I think, of loading like earthquake data or something into right. into the database. And the way and the trick about a lot of this, and this is where it gets a little bit complicated when you're doing the API stuff, is I need to try to make sure I'm not loading stuff unnecessarily. So I may have to mess with my API client so I can get like more access to like the e tag or something in there. I might have to do something weird in order to make sure I'm not getting not doing some more data. And the one of the ways that they handle that is you put a if you can put a unique constraint on a property when you're inserting it, then I believe Swift Data is not going to insert the same thing twice. It'll update it. It'll do like an upsert. Okay. So like you can kind of prevent duplications if you do unique constraints, which I think has worked for me, if I'm not mistaken. So that's pretty cool. So you have to like when you're
go ahead.
Oh, and so that's a good one. Also, this article I mentioned called "Practical Swift Data Building Swift UI Applications with Modern Approaches." That's actually really good article, mm-hmm. and it talks about a technique for using actors at the end. It talks about setting up for testing, which I actually did all this. I have like a little test suite that I started building out while I'm doing this work.
My goodness, testing.
Yeah, I know, testing. And
has it saved your bacon?
Well, it helped me figure out how to get things to work to start with.
Okay.
And then also Donnie Walls has written lots of stuff on Core Data. We talked about him before. He has a book on Core Data. He did a talk on concurrency of Swift Data. We also mentions the actor stuff in there. And that was from like last year at a Cocoa Head somewhere. And there's a YouTube link I'll put in the show notes. So Donnie Walls is a good example too. So, but it's like Swift Data is, Swift Data is pretty straightforward for most things. I mean, you do hit issues. Azam has some good stuff. Azam Sharp, friend of the show, Azam. He has some good stuff on Swift Data too that I've looked at, especially about like some edge cases you might come up into or some common scenarios. I know there's like an issue of like, how do you, for instance, do a dynamic query? There's different approaches for this. Because, you know, like
what is a dynamic query?
Like the query property wrapper, you can't like, as far as I know, you can't just like insert like a variable into it in the predicate or something. So like if you wanted to have a user say like change how many items like put in a search string or something, you're doing it manually. You're not like it's you can't create a query as far as I know that takes in dynamic information easily.
Oh, interesting.
Like there's ways of around it, but it's not like if you just go start a query and you're like, how do I do this? And it's like it's not obvious at first.
So something as vanilla as, say, like, I want to do a search in my entity based on title, right? And so I want to have a list of all my entities. So I guess you pull all your entities back, all your elements.
Well, you can do predicates in there. You can, but there's some limitations with the dynamicism of it. I'm not sure where the edge cases are because I haven't hit them quite yet. Mm-hmm. Although what I was doing for this one bit of data that I was using so far, since it was so small, I was just getting all of the entire collection. Right. And then I was just filtering on that afterwards in the view, but that's because it was like, you know, like two or three or four items. It was really small. It wasn't worth trying to do some custom predicate stuff, but I don't remember the details. I know Azam had a good video on the Swift Data stuff. The stuff with Swift Data, it's like every time I watch them or I was watching them or watching a video or reading something, until I actually tried to write it in code, it was like hard to kind of grok, you know? And then you do it, and you're like, oh,
because okay. Like,
even though it's not that complicated.
I mean, from an aesthetic point of view,
yeah,
I've found it to be quite clean looking.
That's the thing, especially about concurrency. That's where I was watching the Donnie Wall stuff and this article, because it's like, You start doing the actor stuff. You're like, why is this always on the main thread, or why am I getting concurrency? Like warnings, sendable warnings. And if you have that, if you're not using that strict concurrency yet, you should probably turn that on, because you're gonna be amazed at how many times you screw that up.
Is actors? So I'm not I haven't touched or reviewed a lot of the Swift Data code, the sample code from Apple. What are they using actors in those to do what you're saying? Is that something that Apple is encouraging, or has at least through the sample code?
Well, I mean, I think they're encouraging because they made an interface for doing this. They made a macro to make it easy to set up. So actors provide like mutually exclusive attributes to stuff, but the model the model actor in particular controls access to like the container and the context. So
I see.
If you look at the actual code that gets generated, you'll see that what it does, it has an executor in there and it takes on the context that it's created in. So you could do this all manually if you wanted to, and there might be reasons for you to do that. But if you use if you just take the automatic thing, that's why it takes on the context it's in, which is pretty convenient. But it means you just got to be careful. Like this is what I mean, where it's kind of like feels like it hides stuff because it's just doing stuff. It's doing stuff in the background, or it's doing stuff based on like something like where you instantiate it, and you may not be familiar with that kind of a pattern. And the tooling is getting better in Xcode. Like I'm starting to get more concurrency warnings than I used to, even like a couple versions ago of like updates. Yeah. Yeah. So that's helpful. But if you look at that Donnie Walls,
those little purple warnings.
I got some weird purple warnings earlier today, and then they disappeared. And I'm like, I don't, you know. So sometimes
they only get triggered when you actually so when you're testing, when you're doing something in the simulator.
Yeah.
They will only come up when the actual this is an issue kind of thing.
I couldn't recreate them after they went away, and I'm like, I'm doing the same thing. So I don't know. I'm like, okay, it had to be do with HTML. Here's something I want. This is unrelated, but HTML rendering HTML is a pain in the butt in Swift UI. Like, there's no built-in thing for it, and I made one.
So you have a web view, right?
Okay, so imagine you have a web view, but now you have to make it. How do you know what size to make everything?
What size to make it? Is that based on the size of the window, or?
Well, I'm asking. This is where you start going down the drive. So what I had to end up doing was, I have JavaScript that reads like the size of the content once it's loaded, and then has a binding back to the Swift UI, so you can set the frame height so that everything will work in a scroll view. It's slow as all hell, but it works.
So you have a web view inside a scroll view.
Yeah. Because it needs to be like one part of the screen, not the whole screen. It's the only way I've gotten it to work, and it's like painful, and I don't like it. And I have to have like multiple variables, state variables that track things, and like track the height, track the whether I want to open a sheet or something. But it works.
It's just
slow. It's just a little slow. Like it takes like a second to render, which I don't like.
Have you tested it?
Why?
Why does it take a second to render?
Why do you need it?
Because I have like arbitrary HTML I have to render.
Okay.
It's the kind of thing where it could be a variety of reasons, right? Time constraints and or because maybe
How else do you want to render HTML? Is what I'm saying. Like, there's not a lot of good options if you have you don't know what you're getting. Exactly.
I'll just send it to a Safari view controller and.
if it's part of the view. Yeah.
Then not much you can do.
That's what I'm saying. So it's like, you know, and I wanted something kind of reusable. So maybe I'll find something better later. But
is the content that's inside this web view, is that something you have control over, or is that something where you sort of have to,
I don't have control over
the mobile web view, and you're just putting it there because that's sort of the
It's like someone's putting in text in somewhere and adding like bold and links and stuff, and they all have to work. Okay. And I also have some style sheet stuff in there too to make it all work in the app.
But I guess what you can do to get around the sort of jankiness of it is kind of like you can take metal shaders and just like as the thing loads, things like pixelate in.
Well,
like
maybe I have a progress thing, a little spinner that pops up right now.
How dare you?
But that works.
You're gonna do something boring like a loading spinner.
Well, that's just because it's the easiest thing to start with. But I'm with you. I understand. Like that something cool like that. Yeah. Cool. But hey, back to the Swift data stuff.
yeah,
you know, it's. I think it's cool. I will report back on my progress because I'm using it at work and I'm using it for the side project, and we'll see how it works. I've never used actors before now. Like, I never tried to use an actor before, and this is a special case of an actor. But I definitely have hit issues, like, trying to use Swift data before this, where it was giving me concurrency errors and stuff, and so, like, because I was doing it wrong. And so this will, this has been helpful.
Sort of curious. Like, I get the point of using actors in content, with core data.
Yeah.
That makes sense. I guess I'm kind of curious. Is there other opportunities where actors make sense?
Yeah. I mean, if you need to control exclusive access to something, some data, like you don't want to have to use like more like locks and semaphores and stuff.
Okay.
You don't have to do, there's other ways that you basically want to control. You're controlling access to data.
Dude, right. I mean,
like
right.
You're creating exclusive access. The actor model lets you create these like little independent islands that you have to go through the actor to access the data in a controlled manner. And the actor can like more or less guarantee that. In this case, in the model actor one, I think it's basically like a serial queue kind of style. Mm-hmm. So things execute in that order. But however you build it, you're controlling it. And you're creating an interface to the public that, right. You have to go through.
So I guess I'm trying to think of like, for example, like a network, like a
network stuff.
Network manager, right? Like
this work. Yeah.
Would that be something worth like, so, okay, like now my network, my API manager or whatever you want to call it. Right.
Yeah.
Is that something that can be converted to an actor?
You know, I thought about that. I was wondering if maybe I should do, I don't know. I'm not sure if that's
the
appropriate
thing.
But
like, I was never sure whether or not I was getting like that, like aside from like the fact that it's like a reference type, but like literally like a final class. So it kind of is smaller.
Yeah. I have to rewatch the dub videos. There's some dub videos about actor stuff, and they were mostly talking about like distributed software. And where it really came in handy. And that's where I've mostly seen actors used a lot. And in this case, it makes sense because you have this database underneath everything. And you have this whole core data infrastructure underneath of it that's very sensitive to what context or what thread stuff's running on. Like, and the models themselves cannot be passed between contexts. And you have this sendable stuff, which is coming up in Swift 6. It's going to be, you know, like, slamming the door shut on like passing things inappropriately between threads. So the actor system lets you provide a control way. It does have limitations though. Like it's not the way I was first looking at it, your instinct might be, oh, this is going to be like a repository pattern or something. Like traditionally I used to use in like C# or something. I create like an interface to my database. Here's all the functions to do all the stuff, but it's not really that. It's more like you create an actor because you want a background task to like load data from an API into your context, into your database, but you're not gonna do everything with it. Like you wouldn't use it to query data, for instance. Really, you would just use it to like do some writes, it seems, or deletes or something, like things like that maybe in there. Mm-hmm. And it also feels like what they want you to do is maybe even make an actor per model, even because like, they're like very. It's like they're kind of, you need to create them whenever you use them, so they're like. And Donnie Wall's his view of them, you can create them as like very independent little things to do something. I have one actor right now that I'm using to just load data, and that's it. But then when I want to query data, I'm trying to use the other tools like standard query, property wrapper, and fetch descriptors and stuff. I'm not like trying to build a different class to just access the data.
Right, right. Yeah. I think we've both agreed that trying to get too cute with
too cute,
core data.
Every time I try to get too cute, it doesn't end well. Like, don't get too cute. Don't get like architecture astronaut on it. Just like whatever
like stuff.
No, but it's like, you know, for this it makes sense. You know, you have to. I'm trying not to have the app crash. Like, it's so easy to crash things with Swift Data or Core Data. It's like very easy actually. If you do things wrong, it just all of a sudden just blows up, and you get all these crazy error messages. You're like, what is happening?
I mean, that was the biggest complaint about Core Data for the longest, is like setting everything up was extremely tedious. Yeah,
but not now.
And you're never quite sure whether you did it right. And then even then when you were doing stuff like migrations are brittle. You know, you can easily screw that up.
Migrations are pretty cool in Swift Data. I mean, at least theoretically, I haven't gone through one myself yet, but I've looked at the documentation. I started writing the infrastructure for it. I mean, there's like a little pattern. You set up a schema, and then like the migration, you tell it like what schema you're using and in this version, and then you tell it like what the order of the versions are. So, you know, like in version 2, you're going to go from version 1 to 2, and then the next one, you're going to go from like version 2 to 3. And you basically set up, and then there's a way for you to insert custom code in there. If you need to do things during the migration. But if it's simple stuff like you just like you
add a view or remove a view.
I think add
an attribute or remove an attribute.
I'm not sure about remove. Can you just remove an attribute will work? Maybe it'll work because you just delete things. But yeah, there's an automatic the automatic migration for simple stuff that it can figure out. And then the custom stuff, there's a way to do it. And it doesn't, it's not that bad. If you look at the examples anyway, and of course they're just examples, so they're simplified to a point, but it seems a lot easier to keep that in like one place. Mm-hmm. And the way I'm doing it is I'm making sure I'm naming things properly, like putting them in schemas up front, because I know that from experience with this, the work project anyway, from experience, I know this particular data model is probably going to evolve. And so I'm just up front setting things up. You don't have to. You can just do it. And then the second version of your app, you can set up your schemas. You don't have to do them all at once. That's the thing about it, which is nice. It's all in code, and you can build up the complexity and the configuration specifics as you go along. Like if you just start out with Swift data, you can just use the stuff that's in a tutorial where you just add like model container or whatever, and you just put in like your class name and your class type, and just let it set up all the defaults, and it'll work.
How do you deal with referencing like from one to like let's say you have an entity of like recipes, and then inside the recipe you're referencing like different ingredients.
You set up if the ingredients are another model, you set up a relationship. There's an attribute you put on top of the property to mm-hmm. to mark it. And then it will, I think, automatically do inverse stuff, but you can get specific about the relationships. You could set up like deletion rules too. So whether
like a cascade versus
like nilling it out, I think, or something. So you can do that. There's a few attributes you just attach. So by default, if you make something a model, you take a class model, it's kind of like it adds observability to it, which is nice. And it also just makes like everything just takes all the properties and says, these are all the things I'm going to try to put into the database. But there's all the standard stuff you remember from core data is like represented by in code versus in the little visual editor.
Right.
Which I prefer.
Delete.
Yeah. No, but you had to like create all the little things. You had to type everything in I prefer everything being in code. I think that is the way you go. And if you're working in enterprisey stuff on like backends, like everything is in code. Like you're trying to make everything in code. Configurations are in code. Everything's in code, because that way you can put in source control or some other management system, and you can do diffs and all that kind of stuff. Whereas before you had the core data entities were in like their own little file, and you had to like edit them there, and then it would like classes, and it was like a little bit of a pain.
Generate classes.
Or you'd have to write them yourself. Like there was like different ways you could generate the interface.
You can code gen it, or you can write it yourself.
But now you don't have to. Now everything just starts out in code, and I find that much simpler to work with and to conceptualize. And I, the other thing I've done before is I have a codable struct that I convert into a model class, exactly as you'd think. You just init a model class, and you just say my property equals the struct property, blah blah blah, all the way down.
Okay,
very simple. You just have a custom initializer that takes in the struct and does the left right stuff. But the other way I've done it is I've made one of these model classes conform to codable. You can do it. I think Donnie Walls has an article about it too. But you can do it. You just can't do it automatically. You have to do all of the conformance manually, which is tedious as all hell. So unless you use CodeGen, I was like, I'd actually rather just generate a struct and like have it be as automatic as possible, so I don't have to do that. Because I did it once for a few things. I was like, okay, this means you can have one model and you don't have to like. But on the other hand, it's like now you got to deal with conformance for everything. It's like.
Right.
It's like, I don't know. I don't know if it's a good idea or bad idea. I think it kind of depends on your situation. I like the idea of having one source, not have to keep two things together. So in my current case, I've been actually keeping the struct and the model class in the same file. And I just named the struct a DTO. Like I named it, the struct is inside the same scheme as it's like named model name.dto is what I named it. So it's all pretty rational. It's in one place, but you do have to keep them synchronized, which is true. On the other hand, sometimes JSON APIs change, but your data model and your app doesn't, or they're not exactly one for one. And that's where you'd want to have the DTO pattern, which is very common. I've used in other things. But other times where that's maybe not the case, it's just more work you don't have to do if you just, but then you're just going to do more work for conformance to codable. So
just so
pick your poison.
Just so I don't know if we've explained what DTO is.
It's a data transfer object is what I always thought it stood for. And okay. It just means, in this case, it's it's the struct that your JSON converts into. Normally, that would be the end of it in your app. Yep. If you're not using Swift data, then you just use that struct in your view. But if you want to then take that struct and you want to put it into the database, well, you need to convert it into a model, and the models have to be classes. So you either have to have two very closely resembling objects, or you have to have one class that's conformant.
Is it a class, or can you use actors in that case?
As far as I know, it's a class.
Since it's a reference type. The core question is, is it a reference type that you have to make it, yes. Whether it be an actor or
Swift class? Data models have to be classes, I think, specifically, but they're reference types. Yeah, they can't be structs. It doesn't work. You'll just get an error. It won't work. You can't apply model.
That makes sense because underneath the hood, everything is a class, right?
Well, yeah, everything is still NS managed objects or something like them.
Right. Yeah. So under the hood, it's all still classes. So.
And it makes some sense though, because when you're talking about data, you want to have a single source of truth for this stuff. Yeah. And you want to reference it, and you want observability to work. It's hard if you ever. The Point Free guys have talked about making observability a while back, and they talked about the structs and the problems with trying to make structs observable. You have to make choices about how that works when you think about it, because structs are these immutable objects. And so what does it mean sometimes to make a struct observable? You can get in this situation where you're not really sure what it means to do that. Mm-hmm. But when you're talking about a reference type, it's much more straightforward because you have this one thing in memory that you're observing.
Right.
So they have they have a good series on when they were examining observability that is worth checking out for background knowledge on how it all works.
And the Point Free, is it Point Free or
dot
Point Freeze?
No, Point Free, as in FREE. Yeah.
Point Free dot co. Dot io or dot co?
Dot co. Co, I think, yeah.
Okay, that's like my tomato boy dot co.
Yeah, I think that is right. Yeah, is that more expensive than a .com or the same or what?
No, it's cheaper. That's
it is.
Why you do .co?
No. Yeah, .co.
I'm sure they would have chose .com if .com wasn't $40 per year or something.
It might have been taken for all we know.
Yeah, I mean, Point Free does sound like something that would have been taken by now.
Pointfree.com is some GoDaddy. They probably somebody owns it and wasn't want to charge a lot or something.
Yeah.
Whatever, it happens. The Swift data stuff, I'm enjoying it. The reason I'm even trying to use it for this project is because I have a whole bunch of data that's a lot of it's kind of doesn't change that often, but it's all related to each other. They're connected together, so there's relationships. And then I have users who are going to update stuff, and I don't want to be downloading huge amounts of data. And then what I did last time I implemented this with the same data structures, I implemented in Objective-C. I implemented it by saving stuff to the file system, but then I found that I had to load it up into memory again to do to go through and change relationships and stuff like that. And it was slow, updating on one screen. It could take a little while to get the API call back, and then to update the other screen because it was firing off notification center notifications, that kind of pattern. It was really old school, and I found it really slow, and it's memory intensive.
Were you using that as the file system as sort of a local caching sorts?
And basically I wrote it in Objective-C years ago, kind of like you would write it with a core data or something, where all the screens are loading data from some repository. They're not, and it's that it was preloaded from somewhere else for the most part.
I did that with Dividend Calc.
It works. It's just it's not memory efficient at all, and it can be slow. In my case, because of the way the data structures worked, it was slow because I had to go through hundreds of these, and it was this is something that we would use for year after year, and the amount of data in there kept growing. And it was so it got to a point where I feel like it's just a little slow. And I was like, you know what? I'm going to try use Swift Data because that way I can query things and it'll take care of fetching stuff in a memory efficient way. And then I only need to make changes like a little bit. I only need to make changes to like the one model that the user is messing with, and it'll automatically update things. That's the hope anyway. We'll see how it works.
I mean, I'm constantly.
Are you writing anything back to the API, or is it just download?
Yes,
only?
A little bit. Only a little bit though. Like one endpoint or something. I think it writes the end, and like the rest of them, like you know, half a dozen of them are all just mostly data you download once in a while to update the data. But it's there's like one endpoint you download pretty regularly because it's like it's basically like a user schedule or something, right? And then the rest of it, a lot of the rest of it is like locations and like information about stuff that doesn't update all the time. So it, you know, you can just kind of download it. I want to download in the background once in a while, and then and let people do their thing. Right now, it's not downloading in the background because it's in the main context. but it's also like I don't know where I want to put that that download code. So right now, it's when the screen starts up, so it doesn't really matter.
Oh, interesting.
It's because you can't do anything until I have the data. So I was like, I'll just mess around with it. I was like, well, I was getting concurrency weirdness. I was like, with errors or something. I was like, let's make a main context right now.
I guess it's kind of funny. Like, this gets into the whole conversation about caching and like,
yeah, it's so painful.
In many ways, I always am amazed of like how core data is kind of utilized in, as sort of like a pseudo caching mechanism. I mean, which it is in a lot of ways.
You know,
but
Apple
like,
even suggests using it for that, I believe.
Yeah. Sure.
Except they don't really give you much like assistance in how, you know, because as I said, so when you think about it, you're like, what, I have to take JSON and I have to turn it into something and then I have to cache it. But then the way that you do caching with HTTP is like totally different. Like the way the API uses caching is with E tags. And so E tags are understood by the caching layer that's built in the URL session, right? But that's not necessarily enough. Like I might have to do more I might have to get around that because it's like, I don't want every time I try to load the data from the network to necessarily go back into to Swift data. Like at the moment now, I think I'm not sure what's happening right now. I have to like do like some tests. URL sessions cache, if you ask it for data and it's a 304, I think it just gives you back the data that it has in cache, which means that the Swift data part would then be loading it again because it would have data to load. But if there are unique constraints on, I think it will just be doing an upsert, I think. But I have to turn on the debugging to see exactly what it's doing. Because what I don't want to be doing is like churning the database either unnecessarily. So right. I think Ozm made a video about, was it Ozm doing this with e-tags? Yeah, he did a video where he was like, he sent back from his API client a tuple that included the URL session or the URL response, I think. And then in there, he checked for like the e-tag. And he, you know, he did like a manual check to see if, and he saved E tag to like user defaults or something, I think. And that way he was able to only do the insert when there was new stuff.
Yeah. He has a whole video section about it in his workshop or his boot camp.
Yeah.
Comprehensive guide to building data driven apps. Swift Data
Boot
Camp.
Which is good. So I guess to wrap up the Swift Data monologuing here. It's cool. I mean, I thought you were using Swift Data a lot more than I have.
I use Core Data, so I
Core
I don't
Data really, definitely use more than me.
Yeah. In terms of like with relations to Swift UI, so I think we've done it with Conjilove. We've done it with.
Yeah, I found it like cumbersome with Swift UI. I mean, obviously it's doable and it wasn't like that bad, and you had some nice wrappers. But Swift Data and Swift UI, if you want to use Swift Data outside of Swift UI, that's where you start having friction.
No way.
Like, it's not really worth trying that, I think, for the most part. But, you know, but if you're using Swift UI app, I mean, it's actually really well designed for that. I mean, obviously, that's what they designed it for.
I think I do want to actually use it for my Fave 10 app. Like, I want to rewrite that from scratch.
Yeah, I would recommend it. I mean, it's so simple to start with. You can go see how far you can go with it.
Yep. I'm a little scared to do it in the context of like, because that was all built with Core Data and just basic vanilla bench requests.
There is a way for you to convert, and you can also run both at the same time. So, like, they have some documentation on it. I mean, because it is all, after all, the under the surface the same. So I think you can even connect to the same, like, underlying container or something, whatever they call it. I don't know if it's container, but whatever the
I'm
object
pretty
is.
Sure I didn't do anything crazy with that in terms of, like, what I did with that, with Core Data in that app, but we're safe. Yeah.
So, Aaron,
scared to go back.
Do you have any thoughts about Swift Data? Have you used much of it since it came out?
No, I haven't. I need to start up some new side projects.
Well, I mean, I think it's much easier on ramp than Core Data was for a new developer, or someone who's never used one of these, like a database system on iOS before. It's I mean, I know it's not technically that. Don't look at me. I know it's not technically a database. It's not ORM. I know. I understand. But you know, if you need to, you need to take an object graph, put it into a SQLite database. There's other ways of doing it, but this way is built in. It's batteries included, and it works. So I like it. So if you want to give it a shot, it's very easy to get started. Easier than ever to use this kind of persistence layer in your app. And it's pretty easy to then, as you said, evolve it over time. So you might as well try it out and see if you like it.
I will do that. I think we went pretty long on this particular topic.
Yeah,
so actually, I'm going to save the Vision Pro accessibility and the wearable conversation for another podcast, because I think they deserve their own good chunk of conversation bits.
As a little teaser, people, it's cool. Piltrow has some insights that I've not heard about how accessibility works in Vision Pro. So
I explored the voiceover. I explored some accessibility. There are some interesting things to keep in mind when you build it, but we can talk about that.
Yeah, and you tried vision impaired usage, right?
Yes,
which I think is the most interesting thing. How to use a Vision Pro if you're vision impaired?
Vision impaired. Yeah,
it does work, right? So
it works, but we will.
We'll discuss that maybe next time, but definitely in a future one.
So for sure.
For now, we will follow. I think it's time that we do our little wrap up and programmer dad jokes.
Yeah. All right. Well, that's all we have for today. You can learn more about PhillyCoco at phillycoco.org. There you find links to our Slack group, meetup schedule, and contact info. If you're feeling generous, leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or whatever your podcast platform of choice is, and please share us with all your developer friends. And one more thing. What is a Git user's favorite sport? Squash. Squash.
Even Aaron likes that one.
He's done a few in his days.
I do like squash. I like squash and Git.
What is the most logical name for a Star Wars series?
I don't know what.
Andor.
Andor. They actually did have something like that. And Andor, right?
Yeah.
Oh, that's funny.
All right. And finally, two wolves munching on a developer. The first, damn, this guy is bland. The other must be a junior because he is not seasoned enough.
Wow. Did you get these from ChatGPT?
This was a particularly bad one too.
This is
Reddit. This is Reddit.
Oh, Reddit ones. Yeah, jokes. Reddit's really bad. These jokes.
They're classically bad.
Yeah.
Maybe I'll try ChatGPT 4 next, and I'll get back to you whether or not it's better at dad jokes. But till next time, good luck on your own developer journey. We will cheer for you always.
That was the scariest part of Event Horizon for you. The shutters opening?
Well, no, but that was the setup, because the whole thing from that point on was like just disturbing things after disturbing things throughout the entire movie, and I'm just like, okay, yeah, you know what? No, I'm never watching this movie ever again.